This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Michael Ignatieff has an extraordinary story to tell about political idealism, ambition, and failure. It's about his own unlikely rise and sudden fall in the world of Canadian politics.
Here's a bit of background. Ignatieff is Canadian. He's a Canadian-born journalist, writer, and academic who taught human rights and international politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
In 2004, three men in black, as he calls them, came down from Canada and asked him to come back home and lead the Liberal Party. It seemed crazy. He had no political experience. He had spent very little of his adult life inside of Canada, but he accepted. And remarkably, within 2 years, he'd won a seat in Parliament, became the deputy leader of the Liberals, and 3 years after that, the party leader.
Then, in 2011, he tried to unseat the ruling Conservatives in a national election, but the Conservatives labeled him an outsider and crushed the Liberals, handing them their worst defeat ever. Ignatieff even lost his seat in Parliament. His unlikely political career was done.
So here he is in May 2011 in Toronto, delivering his concession speech.
We have to be big enough, open-hearted enough, courageous enough to read the lessons that the Canadian people have taught our party tonight. Leaders have to be big enough also to accept their historic responsibility for a historic defeat, and I do so.
Michael Ignatieff is now back in Cambridge, teaching again at the Kennedy School, and he has a fascinating and honest memoir about his brief political career in Canada. It's called Fire and Ashes, Success and Failure in Politics. And Michael Ignatieff, it's great to have you. Thank you for coming in, and thank you for this book. It was really a delight to read.
Thank you.
And I'd love to talk to you about it, starting with the first chapter, which you call Hubris. Is that what led you to say yes to those men in black who came down from Canada?
I think you have to be a little crazy to go into politics anytime. Hubris is built into politics. You've got to overestimate your abilities and underestimate the difficulties, but boy, that's certainly true in my case.
You know, one of the things you write about, and one of the things, by the way, that impressed me about this book is it does feel so honest, because it seems like you had all kinds of opportunities to sort of justify what happened and bash the other guy. But one of the things that struck me early on is you didn't have a really good answer to the question, why do you want to be prime minister? And I was amazed by that, because that's the first question. I mean, I've been a political journalist. That's the first question I'm going to ask a politician. How did you miss that one?
Yeah, it is kind of amazing. I think it has to do with the fact that I grew up in a family that did a lot of public service, and my father had worked for Canadian prime ministers. And so to the question, why do you want to be prime minister? It was like, I want to do what my dad did. But
yeah,
That's not the kind of thing you can say in public. I think you learn, and you have to learn, that the question of why you want to be prime minister, why you want to be president, why you want to be congressman, why you want to be senator, is who you want to be that for. Who do you want to serve? I'm ashamed to say it took me a while to understand that I didn't understand the question. I mean, I had plenty of reasons why I wanted to be prime minister, but I didn't identify clearly enough who I wanted to serve. But over 5.5 years in politics, I did learn. I met people who needed good government. I met people who were desperate. I met people who wanted to be inspired. And you learned over time those were the people you were doing the job for. And that's the good side of politics. You know, my story doesn't end so well, but I'm here to tell you that the book is designed to encourage people to go into politics and make the plunge.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, you could sort of look at your story as kind of gruesome, because you got beaten so badly. But I mean, I wanted to get to this, and since you brought it up, I'll get to it right now. In the final chapter of the book, you say you might well draw the wrong conclusion from this tale of mine. You might be thinking that politics is a dirty game that should be no business of yours. But you go on to call it a noble calling. And you use the word calling, which is a pretty intentional word that we tend to think of as, you know, in the context of religious service and that kind of thing, right?
Well, it's a, you know, what is politics? It's hard to call it a profession, because, you know, you can lose overnight and go from a position of power to nothing. It doesn't feel like a profession, because it's not like lawyers and doctors. All kinds of charlatans practice the profession of politics. I call it a calling because I think you have to understand that it really is about serving other people. And that's not meant to sound just noble. It's just a fact. They won't elect you if you don't serve them, if they don't feel that you have listened to them, that you have worked for them, that you have delivered the bacon, all that kind of stuff. So I came to understand it as being a vocation, and I met a lot of absolutely extraordinarily good politicians on either side of the aisle. I wasn't so hot, but I sure knew when I met one that they had a kind of instant connection to their people. Mm. They knew, you know, when the great Boston politician said all politics is local, there's deep truth there. They knew the streets. They knew the people. They knew the Lions Club. They knew the Rotary Club. They knew what it was like to be grow up on those streets. And that connection, visceral connection to the people, is one of the sources of being a good politician. I'm not sure I ever had it, by the way.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because you write about this as well, and that is this sort of what it takes to be a good politician, because of course you want to be smart, you want to be up on the issue, you need to be a good public speaker, you need all of those things, but I think you need something that's almost indescribable and unlearnable, a kind of natural thing that great politicians have.
Well, it's that capacity to light up a room, that capacity to hear not only what people say, but what they mean. Mm. We always kid about Bill Clinton that he felt people's pain. Well, he did have a capacity to feel it, to take it inside him. And that's a great political gift. The other political gift that's very hard to describe. Look, I teach at the Kennedy School. I'm supposed to teach this stuff. And one of the things I've learned is it's very hard to teach. Mm-hmm. You can learn it, but you can't teach it. But one of the things is a sense of reality, a sense of what is possible, what is not possible in any given situation. That's one of the reasons, I think, why intellectuals and writers and thinkers often don't make good politicians, because they're not... They don't have a very focused sense of reality. Mm-hmm. And that's a key. You know, what deal is possible here with these people now? You know, can we get a half a loaf here, or should we hold out to get the whole loaf? Mm-hmm. Or should we go home with a quarter loaf? You know, these are judgments. And that's the kind of judgment we ask a politician to make. And the key thing in a politician is not just the touchy-feely, not just the warmth, but this capacity to have good, steady, sober judgment. And it's a very rare quality. And you can have a PhD and have terrible judgment, and have a high school education and have great judgment.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Bill Clinton, because I think whether you like his politics or not, I mean, I saw him up close a bunch of times, and talk about lighting up a room. He had this capacity. If you were one of 300 or 400 people in a room, he had this capacity of making you think that he was talking to you. And then you take his vice president, Al Gore, who I followed around for the better part of a year when he was running for president, and he had everything going for him in terms of the qualifications to be president except that ability.
Yeah, he talked at you, not to you.
That's right.
He didn't listen. Listening is the great undiscussed quality of a great, great politician. When I see a good politician listening, he's hearing what you really feel, not just what you're saying. All these are, and we're so down on politics. We're so down on politicians. We're going through not a terrific period in the political life of this country or in my life, but in my country. But that's really where I wrote the book, to kind of describe on the basis of hard-earned experience, what are the qualities that make for a good politician? And many of the great politicians are local. They're not big stratospheric heroes like Mr. Clinton. They just serve the people, know the people, respect the people. All those are great virtues that I want to kind of praise in this book.
And you do. It's also a story about some tough lessons that you learned. And you mentioned your background, and your father worked in the civil service and worked with the great former prime minister, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name.
Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Pearson is who I was thinking of. And you wrote, "It never occurred to me when I returned home and entered politics that their liberal world and the Canada they made had long since vanished." I'm wondering what you meant by that.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons you go into politics is to kind of save and sustain the streets you grew up in, the world you knew. Mm. There's a tremendous amount of nostalgia in politics to preserve what you love about your country. But countries change all the time. The streets change all the time. And I came back to a Canada that had changed a lot. It had, I think, moved to the right. Its politics was much more influenced by the kind of the attack politics that had first been perfected on the right of American politics and now is practiced right across the spectrum. We like to think in Canada that we're kind of, you know, nice, civil, discreet characters and, you know, put all the bad qualities in the world onto Americans, right, and say we don't have any of them. But in fact, our country's politics was much meaner, much more adversarial than I had suspected. So I think I went back into politics with a certain nostalgic image of Canada that had passed away. And the country, people often say Canada is liberal. It's not liberal. It's, you know, because no country is liberal or conservative. This is a battle. You have to fight to win it. I went to fight for a liberal Canada just as I've been a liberal all my life. But we lost that battle, and I think I discovered that I was fighting for a country that had, in effect, disappeared.
Mm. You know, you mentioned, I was really intrigued to hear you talk about how we think of Canada as sort of, I don't know, gentle, a little more polite than we are down here. And reading your book really disabused me of that idea that I had. You were cast as an outsider from the start, and during your final election, there were really tough negative ads that said Michael Ignatieff just visiting and he didn't come here for you. Really tough stuff. How did you counter that idea that you were an outsider in the sense that you'd spent a lot of time growing up in Britain as an academic here in the States?
Yeah, again, this business about all politics being local, you fight for your standing in politics by proving to people I'm one of you. And I never quite succeeded in convincing them that I was one of them, partly because of the Harvard thing, partly because I'd spent time in, dreaded word, the United States, you know. What did I do to fight it? I got on a bus tour and went through 10 provinces and 3 territories. And since we're a huge country, that's a lot of miles in a bus. Mm. Every time I got out of the bus and shook hands at a truck stop or at a coffee shop, I got a great reaction. When I talked to people one-on-one, I had a sense of people thinking, he's all right, he's not so bad, you know, he's a professor, but that's not so terrible. Mm. But you can't fight an air war. Mm-hmm. With a ground war. They ran negative ad campaigns for 2.5 years of my leadership. It was very difficult to turn this. I never had a feeling when I was in a room with real Canadians that I couldn't bring them over, but we just didn't have the resources to fight the air war with an air war. And that's the kind of politics we've got into, a politics of enemies as opposed to a politics of opponents. We've got into a negative politics everywhere, and turning negative politics around is extremely difficult, unless you have the money and the resources that, for example, Barack Obama had, which, to his credit, he used.
Early in the book, you write a lot about this great belief that you had and that your family sort of raised you with, in the power of government to do good. It forged your political views, the great liberal traditions of people like Trudeau, the Canada that built national highway systems and the St. Lawrence Seaway, the American system that built a great public education system. Are you worried that we're losing the ability to do that anymore?
Well,
politics.
Yeah. One of the things that I think, I'm a liberal, unapologetic, unabashed liberal, but one of the things that we have to think about hard is government capable of delivering good things for people? Is it capable of building the roads on time, the hospitals, the great public goods? The Obamacare rollout fiasco has put a dent in that promise. I just think, though, that in a time of increasing inequality, and we can all see that inequality, the liberal and progressive story is we need public goods that we all share, world-class public goods, whether it's great hospitals, great schools, great roads, great internet, things that we share to bring us together at a time of inequality. And I think that message is still vital and viable, and I think it as long as people understand that if you have those public goods, you've got a life. If you don't have those public goods, you've got a jungle. And that was the message we were trying to get across. And I think it will always be a relevant message.
Well, that's Michael Ignatieff, professor at the JF School of Government in Cambridge. He's author of Fire and Ashes, Success and Failure in Politics. Michael Ignatieff, thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.